This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the presidency of Gerald Ford, a man who is remembered, will be remembered, primarily for two things. One, the way he came to the presidency, taking over when Richard Nixon resigned, and the other for the fact that he pardoned Mr. Nixon for any and all crimes he might have committed in association with Watergate, something that cost Gerald Ford dearly. These two events happened, his coming to the presidency and then the pardon, happened within the first month of his presidency. And this morning we'll be talking perhaps generally about Gerald Ford, but concentrating on the things that happened in that first month. And our guest is Barry Wirth. He's the author of a newly published book, which is titled 31 Days, and it is about, day by day, the first 31 days of the Ford presidency. The subtitle for the book is The Crisis That Gave Us the Government We Have Today. It's published by Doubleday, is out recently, and you can certainly find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read the book. Questions here are welcome. All we ask is that callers try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep our program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone listening may call 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Wirth, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Thanks for talking with us. Do you think that Gerald Ford has been unfairly judged as a not very significant a president?
Yes, I do. I think there are two predominant reasons for that. One is the pardon itself, which came as a great blow to the country. Ford has always insisted that it was necessary, but it came in such a way, so soon after he took office, that that was really the thing that sealed his reputation with his countrymen. They didn't really know him. We didn't really know him much before the pardon, and the pardon stuck to him like glue. So that was the first. And the second was that it was Ford's misfortune to come into office just as Saturday Night Live was beginning. And in that opening season, Chevy Chase parodied him as a stumbler, a bumbler, and kind of a fool. And unfortunately, that stuck as well. So Ford never really got his due, either during the time that he was the president or since, I think, for what he actually took on, which was taking on the presidency after the collapse of Nixon's administration.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about how it is, before we talk about him becoming president, how it is that he became vice president, because he became vice president. He was appointed to the vice presidency after Agnew resigned. So he also has the distinction of being the first president in American history who was not elected president or vice president.
That's right, and he was acutely aware of that, of course. Gerald Ford was House Minority Leader in 1973 when Agnew resigned after pleading no contest to tax evasion charges. And he was not Richard Nixon's first choice. Nixon's first choice was John Connally, who had been the former Democratic governor of Texas, who became a Republican and was Nixon's Commerce Secretary. He thought Connally was the best politician in the country and the one most equipped to move forward with the new coalition that Nixon believed he was building among traditional Republicans and Southern Democrats. But Connally had some problems. He was a turncoat Democrat, as I said, and he also was under investigation with some Nixon-era campaign abuses, and it was clear that Congress wouldn't approve him. So Nixon started to work his way down his list, and Ford, by everybody's reckoning, was about fourth or fifth. And Ford's great advantage is that he was very popular in Congress, having been in the House for 25 years as minority leader for the last several, and did not want to be president himself. This is really quite crucial. Neither the Republicans nor the Democrats wanted to consider that Nixon might name someone who would ultimately become president and then would be a strong candidate in 1976. So Ford became vice president because Nixon needed somebody who was not perceived as a strong candidate in his own right and somebody who would possibly be able to deflect an impeachment proceeding against him in the House Judiciary Committee, and that was Gerald Ford.
Mm. Ford, as I mentioned, Ford paid a heavy price for the pardon. He was widely attacked by people in Washington, by the political commentators of the time, by the American public generally, although I think it's also true that in later years, some of those people who criticized the pardon said that they had been wrong and he had been right.
That's absolutely true.
But certainly public opinion. Even though public opinion was against Nixon, public opinion turned against Ford, and I think that some people would argue that that contributed greatly to his loss to Jimmy Carter in 1976.
Well, it was even, you know, it was even more dramatic than that. You know, Ford came into office and decided quickly after that he actually did have to be a candidate in 76. Henry Kissinger convinced him that he would be an instant lame duck if he didn't announce his intentions soon. But what the pardon did is it so weakened him, made him vulnerable to an attack from the right wing of his own party, which galvanized around Ronald Reagan. When Ford lost to Carter, he had already been through a bruising intra-party struggle where Reagan almost beat him for the nomination. So he ended up making many enemies and very few friends with the pardon, and he exposed himself to a challenge within his own party.
When I realize this is sort of jumping to what happens at the end of the story,
mm-hmm.
but obviously Mr. Ford, when he announced the pardon, felt that it was important that there be some kind of closure, that this sort of open wound had to be stitched up,
mm-hmm.
and metaphorically speaking, and he apparently felt that he was the guy to do it. Somebody had to do it, and that he was going to do it, and he felt that the country would be better off. And of course, a lot of people got very angry.
Mm-hmm.
In retrospect, do you think is it possible to say whether or not that was in fact the right decision to make?
Well, you know, I would hesitate to put myself in Ford's shoes, but let me explain what I think he was going through. There was a tremendous pressure on him from Nixon's people, particularly Al Haig, who had been Nixon's chief of staff, and during that first month was also Ford's chief of staff, and the Nixon family, telling Ford that Nixon was very ill, was deeply depressed, and might well die if this went on much longer. Now, Nixon did live another 20 years, but at the time, all the information Ford was getting is that Nixon was really dangerously ill and at risk even perhaps of committing suicide. So Ford had to deal with the personal consequences of that as well, and he had a certain urgency to forgive Nixon for that reason alone. On top of that, the special prosecutor was about to bring the case against the Watergate cover-up defendants. These were Nixon's three top aides. And Nixon was an unindicted co-conspirator in that trial. And the prosecutor desperately did not want to have to be the first prosecutor in American history to put a president in the dock. So there was a tremendous pressure from the special prosecutor's office for Ford to take this upon himself. And so I think he probably could not have withstood the pressure that he was under to just simply get this past him so that he could take on the other challenges of the presidency, which were, of course, enormous. But did he have to do it? I think he could have done it differently. I spoke with Mel Laird, who was very close advisor of Ford's and who had been Nixon's defense secretary, who said that he and another Republican leader had sounded out the congressional leadership of both parties, and there was considerable interest in the leaders of both the Democratic and Republican parties coming up to the White House and asking Ford, for the good of the country, to pardon Richard Nixon, which would have given him a kind of cover and bipartisan support that he ended up not getting because he took this on himself, and he did it in a secretive way, and he announced it on a Sunday when it just came as another shock to people. So altogether, his apparent haste really ended up damaging so much that he unfortunately didn't get to do the very good things that he was trying to do in that first month, which was to pull the country together. I think there was some healing after Watergate because we weren't talking about it anymore, but I also think that when you have something, a problem that you don't address or that you shove down or stuff aside, it comes back to haunt you. And I think in many ways the imperial presidency of Richard Nixon has come back to haunt us in the imperial presidency of George Bush.
One of the things that I think dogged Mr. Ford ever after was the feeling that a lot of people had that some kind of deal had been struck between Mr. Ford and Mr. Nixon, or between the two camps, that for the that Nixon would resign in exchange for his resigning, that then Ford would pardon him. There, as far as I know, I think this is true, that there has, even though people perhaps still think that, there never has been any evidence that, in fact, any deal was made.
Well, only two people know, and that's Ford himself and Alexander Haig. And they both have said repeatedly that there was no deal. But I believe if you look closely at what transpired, you can see how there was an understanding between them that if Nixon left, he would not be prosecuted. Let me just explain briefly. A week before Ford took office, Haig called Ford urgently and said he needed to see him at once. And when he showed up, he had with him a list of seven different ways that Nixon could leave office and not be prosecuted. And the last of them was that he would leave office and that Ford, his successor, would pardon him. Ford didn't say yes, and he didn't say no, but he didn't throw Haig out either, even though this was plainly an offer of a deal. And when his staff found out, they were furious, so furious, in fact, that they made him call back Haig the following day with a script in front of witnesses saying, in effect, nothing that they had talked about the previous afternoon should be understood by Nixon in any way to mean that Nixon was going to get off. The problem is that there was a phone call at night between the two of them much later. According to Ford, Haig called him and said, "I just want to let you know everything's status quo here. Try to get some sleep." But according to Bob Hartman, who was Ford's closest aide, Ford came to him the next morning and said, "I called Haig last night, and I said to him, Betty and I have talked it over. The country can't go through this anymore. Do whatever you have to do." And I believe in that "do whatever you have to do," there was enough of a wink and a nod for Haig to be able to go back to Nixon and say, "If you leave, you won't be indicted." So we don't really know, and Ford swore to Congress and has sworn since that there was no deal, and he has said subsequently that there was no deal because he never said he agreed to one, but the signal seemed to be that Nixon didn't have to worry about going to jail, and plainly Nixon left office believing that.
We have as our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Barry Wirth. He's the author of a number of books, including The Scarlet Professor, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. His newest looks at the first month of the presidency of Gerald Ford, the title 31 Days, subtitled The Crisis That Gave Us the Government We Have Today. It's published by Doubleday. It is out now. And questions and comments are welcome here on the show. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana listeners. So if you're here locally where we are, use that one. But we also have toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois or Indiana, if you're listening on the air, around the country, if you're listening on the internet, and that number is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Charleston to talk with on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Thank you. Good program, Dave. I enjoy it every day. But in any case, the subject matter today reminds me of the blurring there in the 70s when Nixon resigned under that cloud, and Gerald Ford's takeover of the presidency and all the things that still lingered. And my primary question, I guess, is what role did Ford play when when the Vietnam War was still on? I'm right on that, aren't I? That stuff was still going on.
The Vietnam War.
Yes.
It was winding down. By the following April, we evacuated all our forces and citizens from there.
Yes. Well, it was certainly a lost cause. And then Nixon's bombing of Cambodia That was in 1968, was it not? Or
no, something? That was 70.
Said 1970.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that was part of all that mush that that was there when Ford took over.
That's right.
And then his role in finishing the peace wasn't signed until 70, at the end of Ford's run, was
well,
it?
Well, what's your question, sir?
Well, the peace was actually signed, or the truce.
Yes, it was already signed.
It was already signed in 73?
I believe it was January of 73, but don't hold me to that.
Okay, well, that's why I was asking. I don't have a real lock on, but it that whole aura of events seemed to just saturate local, or, you know, the feelings in the United States at that time.
Sure.
And I guess, you know, his... You know, if Nixon began it, but he bombed Cambodia in the meanwhile, and then all that stuff that went on, and then Ford and his role in that. And my question is, why was this fellow never prosecuted, either one of them?
You know, why were they never prosecuted for the Vietnam War?
Yes.
Well, actually, it's interesting that you raised that point. Ford was not really in a position of leadership, and there was no reason for him to be held accountable for the war. But during Watergate, there were actually four articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. We remember three of them because they passed overwhelmingly, and they had to do with abuse of power and contempt of Congress and the Watergate cover-up itself. But the fourth one had to do with the illegal bombing of Cambodia. And it was considered by the House, but it was not a slam dunk the way the rest of these were. So finally, it wasn't voted on. But there was an attempt, actually, to hold Nixon to account for the illegal war against Cambodia. You're right to raise that question, but Ford would not have been responsible for that in any way.
Even as a surrogate for...
Well, it was done by the time... we still had some people there, but essentially the Vietnam War was over by the time Ford took office.
Well, and it occurred to me, too, during that time, I was too old for that war. Korea was the thing that I was nearly involved in.
Mm-hmm.
But Vietnam and... the events all around that, and with Lyndon Johnson even, you know, I mean, here's this fellow who pumped that up. I mean, it was just madness. And then these people were never called to account.
Well, you're right about that.
Yes, and in today's climate, you know, here we have poor old Milosevic who died in captivity,
mm-hmm.
and then they are hunting that other fellow, Mladic, I think is his name, and now they want to go after... just escapes me right now, but Charles Taylor from, I think it is, an African nation there.
Yes, I think it's best to hold people to account, and then we don't have to repeat these mistakes.
Yes, well, it seems that if you're might, you're right, and that's what occurs to me, and that's what really prompted my call, and all that.
Well, thank you.
Stuff that happened then. And thank you very much, sir.
Well, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Again, our guest is Barry Wirth. He's the author of a new book that is about the first month of the presidency of Gerald Ford. One of the first items of business now for the new Ford administration was to select someone to serve as vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently there were a number of names that were considered. The two who ended up being the main candidates, one was the man who eventually got the job, Nelson Rockefeller. The other, I guess I didn't know this, maybe I wasn't paying close enough attention at the time, the other was George Bush, the previous president and father of the current president, George H.W. Bush. How was it that Nelson Rockefeller ended up being the one?
I think this is a fascinating and relatively untold part of this history. The Ford had an enormous prize to offer, which was the vice presidency. Just as he was selected by Nixon, he was now going to pick somebody who, at the time, because Ford had not yet announced his intentions for 1976, was presumed to be the party's heir apparent, its standard bearer in 76. So, of course, every Republican who wanted to be president campaigned either sub rosa or actively in the open for the job. And nobody campaigned harder than George H.W. Bush. If you remember Bush's career, Bush had been Republican congressman from Houston, and he had lost twice for the Senate in Texas. And his political career would have been over had not Richard Nixon rescued him and first sent him to the UN as ambassador and then made him chairman of the Republican National Committee, which he was at the moment that Nixon resigned. And nobody was more vocal or more loyal towards Nixon during Watergate than George H.W. Bush. So here suddenly Nixon's out, and literally on the day that Nixon resigned, Bush and his people organized a very aggressive campaign for the vice presidency. They set up a boiler room in the Statler Hilton Hotel near the White House, and they called around the country. They lined up all the state Republican leaders. The feeling was that Rockefeller, who was far more prominent and who had been elected in his own right as governor of New York three times, was unacceptable to the Republican right. They despised him. And that ultimately Ford would have to make a more centrist choice, and that would be Bush. As one of Bush's people put it, he's not really everybody's first choice, but he's no lower than second on anybody's list. So Bush became the main challenger to Rockefeller. And then there was a third candidate who was Donald Rumsfeld. At the time when Nixon left, Rumsfeld was our ambassador to NATO. He was living in Brussels, but Ford brought him back to run his transition team, and he was met at the airport by his then former deputy, 33-year-old Dick Cheney. So they, too, arrived in the White House and started campaigning sub rosa, mainly by whispering to reporters in Washington that Rumsfeld was under consideration and one of those on the short list. So they positioned him as a dark horse, and in fact, in the end, it came down to three. It was Rockefeller who got the job, and then George H.W. Bush and Rumsfeld who came in second and third. And what that did is it meant that by the end of the month, of all of the Nixonites at their level, those were the two who were still standing and were best positioned for future roles in national leadership. And, of course, Cheney went along with Rumsfeld. And 2 weeks later, Rumsfeld became Ford's chief of staff, and Cheney became his vice chief of staff at age 33, the second most powerful person on the White House staff.
And then, of course, then later on, Mr. Rumsfeld became Secretary of Defense.
That's right, and Cheney replaced him as Chief of Staff, going from his subordinate to his superior literally in the blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. Rumsfeld apparently got cold feet about going to the Pentagon, and Cheney had to order him to go.
So, and then the fact that then ultimately, later, Mr. Rumsfeld became Secretary of Defense, George Bush, George H.W. Bush, got an ambassadorial appointment, and then later on, Ford named him to be director of CIA. Were those things given to those men? I mean, was it the fact that they were highly positioned and it would be appropriate, or was that in some sense payback for not getting the job as vice president?
Well, hard to know exactly, although they were both. You know, one of the things the two of them did was position themselves superbly to make themselves instantly loyal to Ford. It's interesting about the decision. After losing the vice presidency, George H.W. Bush was sent as our envoy to China. We didn't have an embassy there yet, so he wasn't really ambassador, and that was good because he wouldn't have been able to be confirmed by Congress, as ambassadors must be. But then a year later, when Ford sent Rumsfeld to the Pentagon, he brought Bush back and put him in charge of the CIA, and at the time that was largely viewed as a move engineered by Rumsfeld to take Bush out of contention for the vice presidency or subsequently for the presidency. It was believed that nobody who served as the head of the CIA could run from there for national office. So a lot of people attribute that decision to send Bush to the CIA to Rumsfeld.
So was it Mr. Rumsfeld had his eye on the presidency?
Very much so. It was recognized very early on when he was still in his late 30s and early 40s working in the first years of the Nixon White House. Everybody recognized the way that it was put was that, you know, he would be in the Oval Office and he had this look on his face that seemed to say, I wonder what it would be like to be sitting in that chair. It was noted by quite a number of people, and it's interesting. Rumsfeld made himself so unpopular when he was when he was Ford's chief of staff that he really lost whatever support he might have had for an eventual run for the presidency. He actually tested the waters twice and didn't get much support.
Well, you seem to be wanting to draw some parallels between that time and this, and mm-hmm. here we again indeed have two individuals, Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld, who now have very important positions in Washington. If you take a look at the time that here we're talking about, mm-hmm. and particularly you take a look at any indications of the way they feel about presidential power and this issue of the balance of powers, does that tell you anything, or would you say that now looking at them today and then looking back at them then, you shouldn't be surprised at anything that they've done?
Oh, I don't think you should be surprised by anything that they've done. But let's give them their due for a second. I think one could make the case that ultimately what brought Richard Nixon down is that he had accumulated too much power in the White House. He concentrated power in very few hands. He ran foreign policy basically between himself and Henry Kissinger, cutting out the defense secretary, the joint chiefs, the other members of the National Security Council staff. It was very much a two-man operation, and he overreached in every direction, and eventually that was why Congress saw fit to find him, that he had abused his power and that he had been in contempt of congressional oversight and that he needed to leave. So on one level, you can see Watergate as an unfolding power struggle between Nixon and Congress, which was then controlled by two-thirds Democrats. That's certainly the way that Cheney saw it. So then Ford came in, and Ford was very much weakened as a president. A, he hadn't been elected. He didn't have a mandate. He didn't have his own base, really. And B, Congress had instituted many oversight reforms during the later stages of the Nixon years, the War Powers Act, which meant that the president couldn't just conduct war indefinitely on his own. He needed approvals from Congress. There was a similar act controlling the budget. So what you have with Rumsfeld and Cheney, who worked as mid-level aides in the Nixon White House, was this sense initially of the imperial presidency where Nixon was extremely powerful. And then Ford coming in, and they're running his administration from a position of considerably less power. So you could see how they would want to, again, concentrate more power in their own hands in order to accomplish the goals that they had in mind. And in fact, Cheney has said as much in December in an interview in the New York Times. He said, a lot of what we're doing here has to do with what we consider to be a loss of power of the presidency in and around Watergate and Vietnam.
A little bit past the midpoint here in this conversation with Barry Wirth. His book is 31 Days, The Crisis That Gave Us the Government We Have Today. It's published by Doubleday. Looks at the first month of the presidency of Gerald Ford. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. Ford reacted against the kind of setup that existed in the White House, at least in the sense that this kind of model of it being a very tightly closed world where it was the president and his immediate circle that were making the decisions and nobody got to them. Mr. Ford said, well, this is not the way that I want to run the presidency. I want to have a more open presidency. In fact, initially, he even decided that he didn't want to have a chief of staff.
That's right.
And the metaphor for the way the House, the White House was organized, at least right at the beginning, was spokes and a wheel. That is, he was in the center and that all of the other various people around him, his various advisors and staff people, all, I guess the idea was that they would have equal kind of access to him, or at least that they didn't have to go through somebody else to get to him. Now, maybe that turned out not to function very well, and later on that changed. But what was Ford thinking about as he thought about what the character and the organization of the White House staff and the cabinet was going to be?
Well, Nixon blamed his top aides, H.R. Haldeman, H.R. Bob Haldeman, and John Ehrlichman, his so-called Berlin Wall, for Watergate. That they didn't, he was not getting the information that he needed, that they were insulating him from other people. Now, of course, this is not true. If you listen to the tapes at all, Nixon was directing Haldeman and Ehrlichman, telling them precisely what to do regarding Watergate and a host of other crimes. But when Ford came in, he believed that he, and remember, his experience had been in Congress, which is much more collegial, that he needed to see a lot of people and hear a lot of opinions and then make decisions himself. In fact, what happened was when Rumsfeld and Cheney took up the running of the White House, they started to establish a conduit very similar to what we have today, especially between the Defense Department and the White House. So that Ford was, by the end of his term, he was getting very limited opinion, and in fact, he was getting a lot of information that was being developed by the neoconservatives who Rumsfeld had brought into the Defense Department. So, and he started out with this idea that the president really needs to see and hear a lot of people and make his own decisions, but he ended up, I think, being captive in many respects of Rumsfeld and Cheney, just as I think Bush has been.
Mm-hmm. When, looking back again, it's obviously it's easy to ask questions looking back to say was something or other a mistake, but he did, one of the difficulties that he had right at the beginning was that he had some people that were part of the Nixon administration and some people that he brought in, and there was a lot of infighting apparently between the two camps, the former Nixon people and Ford's own people.
Right.
Was it a mistake not to simply get rid of all of those people that had been associated with the Nixon administration?
Again, it's very hard to second guess Ford. Imagine Ford had 48 hours from the time that he was told absolutely that he was taking over as president until he actually took office. No time to put together his own staff, no time to put together a transition plan. And the country faced an enormous array of problems. We forget this now, but besides the wind down of the Vietnam War, this was just the beginning of we had the first energy crisis and the rise of the militant Arab states. We had, as Henry Kissinger put it, probably the most uncongenial domestic environment since the Civil War. People were really at each other's throats during Vietnam, and Ford had to lead. So it's easy to say he would have helped himself considerably if he had just gotten rid of all of Nixon's people as soon as possible, but who was he going to replace them with? And he also had, I think, a sentimental attachment. I think he felt that a lot of these people had served Nixon, as he had, right to the bitter end, and had been exploited by Nixon, who had lied to everybody about his role in Watergate, and that these people deserved better than to be thrown out on the street. So so he was not decisive in the beginning, and it really caused him problems because, you know, here he was dealing with a very entrenched force that was running the country, and he kind of had to capture the White House bit by bit.
Mm. Among the problems that he had to deal with was the economy. Inflation was running very high.
Right,
and I think
yeah.
if any people, again, will remember something about Gerald Ford, it's the win buttons.
Yeah, that was a disaster, unfortunately.
This win stood for whip inflation now. So they had all these buttons made and said people should wear these buttons. But apparently he didn't really, besides giving out buttons, he didn't really have much.
Well, Nixon, let me try to set the scene here. We had an economic situation in 1973 and 1974, particularly after the oil embargo and a 400% increase in gas prices that we haven't had before or since. It was referred to as stagflation, which meant that there was high inflation at the same time that the economy was stagnating. And nobody knew how to deal with this. In fact, at one point, Nixon introduced wage and price controls to try to keep inflation down. And at the end of his term, Nixon started, and the congressional leadership started talking about a summit conference where they were going to bring together all the reigning economists in the country, and they were going to come up with some kind of consensual solution for the country. And Ford seized on this in his first 31 days and started the ball rolling on it. And he was very popular during this period, so people were really willing to kind of subsume their antagonisms and work together in ways that we hadn't seen in some time. But then after the pardon, he lost so much approval and popularity that everything he did turned into a far greater strain, and that was true of this economic summit as well. In the end, there was no agreement about anything, and this win proposal was one of a couple of dozens, but it sort of became the face of Ford's economic program because it was so visible. He put on this button that said WIN, and people just thought it was ludicrous, which it certainly was, but there was more thought in the effort than he was given credit for.
Let's talk with someone else here, a caller listening in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, hi. How many times was George H.W. Bush elected to Congress?
Oh, you know, I'd have to look that up. I think four, maybe.
Four
terms.
Really?
He was a popular three or four, maybe even five, but I don't think so, term congressman.
I guess I thought he'd only been elected maybe for one term. Or
no, he was reelected a couple of times, and he was very popular in his Houston district, but he couldn't win the state of Texas. He tried twice and lost.
I mean, I guess the reason I ask is I always sort of thought of George H.W. Bush as our first appointed president. I mean, his power was basically based on the fact that Ronald Reagan appointed him to be vice president. And yes, he was elected president on that basis. But it always occurred to me that he came to power with not through a political elective process, but through a kind of bureaucratic appointed process.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, that's the route that he rode, and he rode it right to the top.
And I guess I'm just wondering what you think the implications. I mean, here we have Cheney, who was elected, what, one time in Wyoming, or twice?
I think he was reelected a couple of times, too.
And then Rumsfeld, who was also elected. I mean, these people were elected to Congress, and that's fine. But we've got a lot of really powerful people here who have become powerful just by being political insiders, not by being politicians. Not that I love politicians.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and I absolutely agree with you. You know, but if you're going to make that case, I guess you also need to look at, say, the former generals who became president who were never elected.
Yeah, well, no, that's right. No, there was
Eisenhower and Grant and
right.
And Washington, I mean, I guess, if you want.
Yeah, I mean, up until this phenomenon, there were two ways of becoming president, to be a general, to be a politician.
Right. And now there's a third way, to be an insider.
Now there's a third way, and it isn't that I liked Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton for being, you know, somewhat more, you know, rising up in a somewhat more honest way.
Uh-huh.
But I just, it's just scary when you think of these people who realize that they don't have to pay their dues politically. They just have to know the right people.
And then get their hands on the levers of power. You're right. I think that when Rumsfeld was a rising politician and had his sights set on higher office, he initially thought that becoming chief of staff and then defense secretary would probably get in his way. And maybe it did, because he never did win national office. But I think he discovered at the same time that he could become a kind of politician / bureaucrat and still wield enormous power.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We have
about, thanks for calling.
15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Barry Wirth. He's the author of the new book, 31 Days. It is published by Doubleday. It is the story of the first month of the presidency of Gerald Ford. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. This was, we talked a little bit about economics of the time. We at least touched on the fact that the Vietnam War was still going on, although it was winding down. The Cold War was also going on at this time. Anything interesting or noteworthy that has to do with the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union?
Well, yes, I think so. You know, this is one of the great ironies, historic ironies, I think. But we almost had a major confrontation with the Soviet Union during October of 1973, the Yom Kippur War, when Syria and Egypt, which had been allied with the Soviets, attacked Israel on the holiest day of the year. And Israel, of course, was our ally in the area, and actually, we at one point went on high nuclear alert during that war. And then, what ended up happening is the Soviets supplied its clients, we supplied Israel. Israel won, although it really got bloodied. And then after that, the Arab states unleashed the oil weapon that was the first oil embargo. And in the aftermath of all of this, during Watergate, as Nixon's presidency was unraveling, Henry Kissinger negotiated the first disengagements between between all the warring powers, actually, first in the Sinai, then in the Golan Heights. This was the famous period of shuttle diplomacy. So as Nixon was going down, Kissinger was soaring and restoring U.S. credibility in the world very rapidly after Vietnam. Now, this is before the disclosures about Chile and some other things that would eventually bring Kissinger's star down, too. But what you had was a moment, just as Nixon's presidency was coming undone, which the Soviets couldn't understand at all. It made no sense to them that, as they put it, you know, that he could lose his job over some, you know, over a break-in. It was absurd to them. But at the same time that was happening, Kissinger was organizing the beginnings of a nascent peace process in the Middle East that would result ultimately in the Camp David Accord 5 years later. And our position and standing in the Middle East was never higher. In June, 2 months before Nixon resigned, he went to Egypt, and which had, as I said, been a Soviet client, which was now becoming a friend of the United States. And he and Anwar Sadat rode in an open car between Alexandria and Cairo, an open car. And there were millions of people along the route chanting, Nixon, Nixon, Nixon. Now, I mean, it's almost inconceivable when you think about our, you know, our standing in that part of the world today. So the Cold War was shifting, and we had, you know, we had developed certain advantages through diplomacy. At the same time, the Republican right and the neoconservatives were arguing that by negotiating the first strategic arms limitation agreements with the Soviets, that the United States had been defeatist and was becoming provocatively weak, and they were pushing for a much strengthened, more militant posture towards the world. And that included, ultimately, Rumsfeld and Cheney. So you have a sense right from that moment how there was a split in the foreign policy establishment, and that we went from where we were then to where we are now.
All right. Well, we have some other callers here to talk with. Let's go next to Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
It's hard to know where to start. There's a lot of commonplaces of American history and international history that get glossed over, and I know you realize you probably agree that they're more complicated than can be dealt with in a phrase.
Sure.
On a talk show. One thing that I think our previous caller, since I recognize his voice and his point of view, he's very critical. He would say that the Arab countries actually attacked the occupied territories. They didn't actually attack Israel, and
right,
that's what they were calling for. But putting that aside, I just I read part of Dick, The Man Who Is President, which has been republished as another with another title, I guess, by John Nichols, who's the Washington correspondent for Capital Times.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some chapters in there that cover the Rumsfeld and Cheney relationship and the Ford days. And one of the things I wanted to get you comment on is he makes the case that Cheney, by being as conservative as he really is, as illustrated by some of the votes, his single digit exceptions. He was the number seventh voter against, let's say, just calling for the release of Nelson Mandela or something like
right,
that. That basically he lost the election for Ford. I don't know. That maybe that's too pedantic. But the portrait of Cheney and Rumsfeld is quite interesting. As you mentioned, they sort of reversed positions.
Yeah, well, you know, Cheney, as chief of staff, was really Ford's chief political advisor during the 1976 campaign. And I can give you one example of, well, two examples, really, of something that Rumsfeld and Cheney seem to have been responsible for, which may well have cost Ford the nomination. We'll never know, of course. But in the what-if category, first, Rumsfeld pushed hard for Ford to dump Rockefeller from the 1976 ticket, and Ford ended up saying later on that it was the most cowardly thing he had ever done. He should have just stood up to the ultra right of the Republican Party and said it's Ford and Rockefeller no matter what. But and then he replaced him with Bob Dole, who was supposed to be more acceptable to the right, but didn't have any of Rockefeller's standing or stature. Rockefeller was chosen initially in part because it was thought that he would be able to help Ford win New York, California, and Florida in the election. But then Cheney took over, and Ford was confronted by this right-wing insurgency within the party in the candidacy of Ronald Reagan. And at one point, there was a platform plank, the foreign policy platform plank, was presented, and it was completely opposed to Ford's own foreign policy. And Cheney said to him, "Just go along with it. policy planks don't mean anything. If you refuse to sign on to this, you'll just inflame the right. So Ford ended up actually running on a foreign policy plank opposed to his own foreign policy because of Cheney's recommendation. So, you know, it's hard, as I say, to know whether Cheney actually blew the election for him. But it's a legitimate concern to think that maybe neither Rumsfeld or Cheney served Ford very well in the end.
There's also that quip about the gaffe at the Ford saying that Poland wasn't an oppressed satellite, and supposedly there are people who make the allegation that Cheney and Rumsfeld, who are known for not wanting to say they're wrong, even when it's something that's so contradictory to their own stance. I mean,
yeah,
they believe that, but they didn't want him to look like he was
flip-flopping.
If they had done something immediately,
you may be right, but that's, you know, that seems like ancient history now. But interesting points.
But if Ford had somehow managed to win, maybe with the Rockefeller, things would have gone a lot different. A lot of people think that Ford was fairly, you know, innocuous, but you know, he and Kissinger had his way in the foreign policy dimension.
Well, there was really a struggle going on for the soul of the Republican Party, and interestingly, Ford, after Vietnam and Watergate, thought that the Republican Party needed to move to the center in order to survive, in order to lead, and he ended up losing that fight to the Reagan forces, and those forces ultimately, you know, produced the environment where George H.W. Bush and then Rumsfeld and Cheney and George W. Bush were able to come to power.
Well, that I want to jump in here. Carl, forgive me, because we're coming down to about our last minute or two. But this is a point that I think you argue in the book, and I think it's an interesting one. That is that we talked about some of the various prices that Mr. Ford paid for the pardon.
Mm-hmm.
One of them being perhaps him being really denied a being elected, actually, as president. But I think you do indeed make the argument that also one of the things that resulted was a strengthening of the right wing of the Republican Party.
Right. This month, the reason why I say this month gave us the government we have today is that Nixon left, there was a power vacuum, there was a direction. The question of what direction the country and the Republican Party would go was really up for grabs, and Ford had a very clear vision, as I said, of where he thought everything should go. And then by the choice of Rockefeller, which galvanized Reagan into a candidate, and then by the pardon, which exposed Ford to this challenge from within the party, this month ended up setting up the sort of ultimate battle for the struggle for the direction of the Republican Party, and since the Republicans have largely been in power over the last period, the direction of the country, and gave us Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, and put them on their path to power. So and also the neo came in with Rumsfeld and Cheney as agents of tearing down the Nixon-Kissinger foreign policy and trying to do away with realism in foreign policy. So all these forces came to bear at the same time, and then somewhat unified afterwards, took the country in exactly the opposite direction of the one that Ford was attempting to lead it in.
Mm. I realize we touched on this before, but again, just very quickly going back to the decision of Rockefeller to have him as the vice president, that was even early on there, that was had to do with Ford positioning himself for a run in his own right.
Ford wrote about that decision in his memoir. He said, "I meant to leave the right sputtering, the Republican right sputtering," was his word. I mean, he knew what he was doing, and he thought that Rockefeller was the strongest. Rockefeller had an independent international reputation. And as I said, they thought that he could help win these key states, the big states that had been Democratic for so long. So it was, you know, it was an alternative route for the Republicans to have gone, but it got crushed very early on because Ford booted away his approval. But he was, as I continue to say, extremely popular at the end of the month. People liked what he was saying and doing a lot. And he made some very bold moves. His first trip outside of Washington, he went to the VFW convention, the most critical group he could find, and announced that he thought that there should be some amnesty for Vietnam draft resistors and evaders. He was a courageous figure, but it's almost as if he had two terms, the first term, which ended at the end of the first 31 days, and then the second term, which was everything else.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing that you point to there, that he made this decision to, that he wanted to have this amnesty. And now today, one can scarcely imagine a president going into such hostile territory to make an announcement like that. You just don't do that.
No, not even close. And he did it, and he knew exactly what he was doing. And afterwards, you know, he wasn't booed, which Al Haig warned him he might be. But they sat on their hands. They were absolutely silent. And then they unanimously voted to disapprove. And Ford said, you know, I thought it would have been cowardly to go to a hand-picked audience. I wanted to go to an audience that was going to be challenged by that, because this is the people that I really need to convince. Yeah, unbelievably courageous by today's political standards.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish here. Mr. Ford is still with us. He is the oldest living American president. He's had some health problems lately, so one doesn't know. One, of course, wishes him well. But how do you think he will be remembered, and will he long primarily be remembered really for one thing, and that is for pardoning Richard Nixon?
Well, I think he'll be remembered also for restoring a sense of confidence in the White House. You can't, I mean, you had to have been there to really appreciate what Nixon did to the White House. You know, not only did Nixon resign because he was facing certain impeachment, but 40 members of his administration, or the committee to reelect the president, were indicted, and many of them went to jail. And Ford ran a very clean administration, and people started to believe again in the presidency. And so he'll get credit for that too, I think, just for simply, you know, taking up and steering the plane after Nixon went down. But yeah, it's unfortunately going to be shadowed by ambiguity because of the pardon and the way that the pardon was negotiated.
The book is 31 Days, The Crisis That Gave Us the Government We Have Today, by Doubleday. Our guest this morning, the author, Barry Wirth. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.